They got all manner of detective agencies, and one agency indeed put an advertisement in either the Times or the Telegraph of London advertising for Lobsang Rampa. He should write to such and such an address where something very good was waiting for him. I knew this was a catch, and so I told my agent, Mr. Cyrus Brooks. He got his son-in-law to phone to see what it was all about. Yes, it was indeed a catch. An author in Germany was mightily peeved that I had written about Tibet when he thought that was his own private inviolable province, and so he tried to have me traced up so that he could decide what action he could take against me. At about this time people connected with the young lady who was living with us took a dislike thinking that I had led her astray. I hadn't, and they also had a private detective trying to find out about me. But this poor fellow, well, it seems to me that he wasn't very bright. He never even tried to get in contact with me. I wonder if he was afraid or something. But instead of asking me outright as a man, he relied on hearsay evidence, and as anyone should know, hearsay evidence is not legal evidence, is it? But the two sides came together and they went to some press reporter who wasn't very popular with his fellows. They tried a few traps which I saw through. But when later we had moved to Ireland, these people made a great campaign against me in the press, saying that I was doing black magic rites in the bottom of the house, that I had a secret temple, that I was guilty of all manner of sex orgies, etc., and that at some time in my career I had been in trouble with the police. Well, that was easy. I had always been in trouble with the police, but I had never been charged with anything, and I had never truly done anything worth police attention. But there is no point in stirring up old troubles and raking up ashes which should be burned out, but I want here to pay testimony to the husband of the young lady. He was and is a gentleman, he is a very good man. He is still our friend, and as he well knew and, indeed, as he testified, the statements about me were quite wrong. No, I am saying no more about this, nothing about the press, nothing about the relatives of the young lady. She is still with us. Still with us as a loved daughter. So there you are, that's all there is to that. When all this happened we had moved to Ireland, and one thing and another had conspired to ruin my health. I had coronary thrombosis, and it was thought that I was going to die, but the press made life so hideous that we had to leave Ireland, which we did with extreme reluctance. I had many friends there, and I still have those self-same friends. We left Ireland and went to Canada where we are now. We moved about Canada quite a lot, we went to different cities, went to different provinces. But at last we had a letter in the mail which offered a lot. In the mail one day there came quite a thick letter. The stamps were from a country of which I knew at that time remarkably little. It was from Uruguay, the country in South America which rests between Argentina and Brazil. The letter was interesting. It told me that the writer was the head of a big company where they did printing, book publishing, everything. I was asked to go to Montevideo at the expense of that company, and I could continue my work there. I would be provided with secretaries, typists, translation services, in fact everything that I wanted. The writer sent me a photograph of himself looking quite impressive behind a big desk with an IBM typewriter in front of him, a lot of books behind him, and, I think, a Philips dictating machine there as well. We discussed it, we being my wife and our adopted daughter, and after quite a time we thought that it would be a good idea. So we made all the necessary inquiries and at long last, because formalities took our time, we got on a train at Fort Erie, Ontario, Canada, for the trip to New York. We were told that we were going to be passengers aboard a more McCormack freighter, one which normally took 12 passengers. In New York everything, as usual, was bustle and commotion. We stayed the night at one of the big hotels and the next morning we set off for the Moore McCormack dock in New York Harbor, and I was highly amused when I found that that dock was one right opposite the one to which I had made my swim so many years ago, it seemed. However, I said nothing, because there is not much point in raking up bitter memories. But, I confess, I kept quite a lookout for river police. We went aboard the ship and found our staterooms, and so late at night with four locomotives loaded aboard on the deck we steamed away to First Victoria in Brazil. There we went up a long inlet before we arrived at a very picturesque, Very hot little community. That was our first port of call. Then we went down to a place nearby so that the locomotives, they were diesel locomotives for the Brazilian railroads, could be unloaded. There were two or three more stops in Brazil until we were cleared for Montevideo in Uruguay. But as we approached Montevideo, actually we were at Punta del Este, the captain was informed by radio that we could not land in Montevideo because there was a dock strike on, so we went to Buenos Aires first and we stayed in that port for about a week. It was quite a busy port, and we saw an enormous number of foreign ships come in. German ones seemed to be the most popular ones, and quite a lot of ships, it seemed, were going straight up the river which forms the frontier between Argentina and Uruguay. We were told that a few miles further up there was a great meat packing plant. The plant of Fray Bentos. At last, though, we were clear to leave port and down we went along the Rio de Plata, and at long last we came to Montevideo, our destination. We got into the outer harbor and the ship had to drop anchor. There had been a strike and a whole fleet of ships was assembled, and they had to be attended to first because they were there first, so we stayed aboard ship for about a week. At last the ship was allowed to enter harbor and we went ashore. Our hopes were completely dashed, however, because we found that the man with an immense business did not have such an immense business after all. Instead, well, to put it at its kindest, he was a man with ideas which did not always work out. It was very expensive living in Montevideo. They seemed to have a peculiar idea there that everything had to be paid for in American dollars, so, in effect, taking into consideration the rate of exchange, we were paying fantastic sums for even basic items. However, we stayed there for a year and a half. Then we found there were all manner of strikes and increasing restrictions on foreigners, so we decided to leave. It is most unfortunate that we had to leave because Montevideo was a nice place indeed. The people, for the most part except for the strikers, were very pleasant, very courteous, and it was like being in a European city. It was a beautiful city with a wonderful harbor and beaches. For a very short time we stayed at a place called Carrasco, quite near the airport. This had one terrible defect in that very fine sand from the immense beaches was always getting blown into the houses, so as we were also too far from the city center we moved to an apartment building which overlooked the lighthouse. A few miles out in the approaches to the harbor there was a wrecked ship. It had been a quite large passenger liner and for some reason the ship had been sunk just off the main entrance, and there it remained. At low tide one could just see the main deck, at high tide the bridge, and the bridge deck was still above water. We saw quite a lot of smuggling going on here because the ship was used as a drop for smugglers. There were many beautiful sights in Montevideo, including a high eminence just across the other side of the harbor. This was known as the Mountain, and there was a sort of fort, which was a local tourist attraction, right at its peak. The British had done much to modernize Montevideo. They had started its bus service, and they had also started the gasworks, and one of the advantages of that was that so many people had a smattering of English. One day when we had moved to yet another apartment closer into the city center, the sky turned black and for a time everything turned bitterly cold. Then there came a cyclone. Three of us struggled to close our open window, and as we were there congregated, pushing our shoulders hard against the window, we saw an amazing sight indeed. The bus station roof just below us suddenly vanished, all the sheets of corrugated iron were flying through the air as if they were made of tissue paper. We looked down and saw all the buses there and workers were gazing up wide-mouthed and with wide eyes. A really amusing sight for us was when hens, which had been kept on the flat roofs of houses in Montevideo, were blown straight up in the air and crossed street after street in probably the only flight they ever had in their lives. It really is an astonishing sight to see hens go flying by with their wings tight to their sides. A sight which really made me amused was when a whole clothesline laden with newly washed clothes went sailing by. The line was as tight and as stiff as an iron bar, and sheets and unmentionables were hanging straight down as if in still air. I have seen many cyclones, whirlwinds, etc., but this from my point of view was quite the most amusing. But Montevideo was losing its charm, so we decided to return to Canada because of the various groups of communists who were making trouble. In many ways I am sorry for it because I think I would rather live in Uruguay than in most other places. They have a different mentality there. They call themselves the Oriental Republic of Uruguay. It is a poor country with wonderful ideals, but ideals so idealistic that they were impractical. We returned to Canada by sea, and then there was the question of making money, so I had to write another book. My health was deteriorating a lot, and that was the only thing I could do. During my absence I found that a person had written a book on material I had written for an English magazine some years previously. He was a very peculiar sort of person. Whenever he was tackled or threatened with a law case, he conveniently went bankrupt and friends or relatives bought his business, so there was not much redress, in fact there was none. One of the big troubles I have had since the Third Eye is the number of people who write approved by Lobsang Rampa, and just put labels to that effect on the goods they supply. All that is quite intense. I do not approve things. Many people, too, have impersonated me, in fact, on quite a number of occasions I have had to call in the police. There was, for example, a man in Miami who wrote to a bookseller in San Francisco in my name. He actually signed my name. He wrote a lot of Holy Joe stuff, which I never do, and he ordered a lot of books to be sent to him. Quite by chance I wrote to the bookseller at the same time from Vancouver, and he was so amazed at getting a letter apparently from me and in British Columbia that he wrote to me and asked how I was moving so quickly. So it came out that this fellow had been for some time ordering goods in my name and not paying. As I said, if anyone is fool enough to take as me the gollygook that this fellow had been writing deserves to get caught. There have been others, such as the man who retired to a mountain cave, sat cross-legged with darn little clothing on him, and pretended to be me. He advised teenagers to have sex and drugs, saying that it was good for them. But the press, of course, seized on such incidents and made quite a commotion, and even when it was proved that these imposters were impersonating me, the press never got round to reporting the actuality of what happened. I am utterly, utterly, utterly opposed to suicide. I am utterly, utterly opposed to drugs, and I am utterly, utterly opposed to the press. I think that the average pressman is not fitted to report things on metaphysics or the occult. They do not have the knowledge, they do not have the spirituality, and, in my opinion, they just do not have the brain power. After a time in Fort Erie, to which we returned from South America, we went to Prescott, Ontario, where we lived in a small hotel. The manager of that hotel was an extremely fine man indeed. We stayed there a year, and during the whole of that year there was never at any time the slightest disagreement or slightest lack of harmony between management and us. His name was Ivan Miller, and he was a real gentleman, and I wish I knew his address now to again express my appreciation of all the efforts he made. He was a great big man, huge in fact, and he had been a wrestler. Yet he could be more gentle than most women. Chapter 11, it was good to be back in Canada to get what was then a reliable My One service. There had been quite a lot of trouble in Uruguay, and one particular incident which really made me foam with fury was when, as an author, I had a lot of mail sent to me and the post office in Montevideo would not let me have it. I had my adopted name, and I also had the name under which I wrote, T. Lobsang Rampa. And the post office officials in Montevideo were quite adamant in not letting me have mail for two names. Their idea was that a person must be a crook if they had to have two names, and so I gave the matter much thought and came to the conclusion that I was far better known as T. Lobsang Rampa. Then I went to the post office and said I wanted the mail for T. Lobsang Rampa, and they could retrain the rest. Then they had to see my papers. My papers had the wrong name on them, so I was unable to get my mail. Eventually I had to go to a lawyer and a bogado and have a change of name deed drawn up. It had to be done legally, and there were many, many stamps on the document, after which notice had to be given in an Uruguayan legal newspaper all about the name change. When all those formalities were completed, then I could get mail in the name of T. Lobsang Rampa, but I was forbidden to use the other name. Now, of course, My name has been legally changed in Canada as well to T. Lobsang Rampa, and while we are on the subject of officialdom, bureaucracy, etc., I am now a Canadian subject. I took out Canadian naturalization and, here again, the formalities were truly amazing. But there seem to be formalities in everything nowadays. I have been trying to get the old age pension, to which I am entitled, but bureaucracy is such that apparently I cannot get it, or so the officials telephone one me unless I give the exact address and the exact dates of arriving and leaving every place I have been in Canada. Well, I have been to an amazing number of places, from Windsor to Prescott, to Montreal, St. John, New Brunswick, Halifax, all the way on to Vancouver, back to Calgary, etc., and I should have thought that I was well enough known as a Canadian citizen and with a passport, etc., but apparently that does not suit the bureaucracy mad officials. So the matter is still pending. It sounds more like a rotten apple than anything else, doesn't it? Last night I was very unwell indeed, and late in the night I awakened from an uneasy doze and found clustered around me a group of those who were my associates, lamas from Tibet. They were in the astral, and they were agitating for me to get out of the body and go over and discuss things with them. "What is the matter with you all?" I asked. "If I feel any worse than I do now, I shall be over there permanently." The Lama Minyadon up smiled and said, "Yes. That's what we are afraid of. We want you to do something else first. When one has done astral travel for as many years as I have, there is nothing to it. It is easier than stepping out of bed, so I just slipped out of this body and went into the astral. Together we walked to the side of the lake on which there were many water birds playing. Here in the astral, you know, creatures have no fear whatever of man, so these birds were simply playing in the water. We sat on a moss-covered bank, and my guide said, 'You know, Lobsang, there isn't enough detail given about transmigration. We wanted you to say something about peoples who have used transmigration.' Well, the day in the astral was too pleasant to be much of a crosspatch, so I indicated that on the morrow I would get to work again before the book was finished. It was very pleasant, though, being in the astral. Away from pain. Away from worries and all the rest of it. But, as I was reminded, people do not go to Earth for pleasure, they go because they have something to learn or something to teach. Today, then, is another day, the day when I have to write something even more about transmigration. In the days of Atlantis, and oh yes, there really was Atlantis, it is not just a figment of a writer's imagination, Atlantis was real. But, in the days of Atlantis there was a very high civilization indeed. People walked with gods. The gardeners of the earth were ever watching developments on Atlantis. But those who are watched are wary of the watchers, and so it came about that the gardeners of the earth used the process of transmigration so that they could keep a more subtle form of watch. A number of bodies of suitable vibrations were used by the spirits of gardeners. And then they could mingle with humans and find out just what the humans really thought of the gardeners and were they plotting. The gardeners of the earth who looked after that mysterious civilization known as the Sumerians also had tutors come to the earth by transmigration. It was altogether too slow to have great spaceships cross the void taking such a long time. By transmigration it could be done in a matter of seconds. The Egyptians, also, were largely controlled and entirely taught by higher entities who entered into specially cultivated bodies, and when those bodies were not actually being used by the entities they were carefully cleaned, wrapped up, and put aside in stone boxes. The ignorant Egyptian natives, catching brief glances of the ceremonies, came to the conclusion that the gardeners were preserving the bodies, and so those who had witnessed such proceedings rushed home to their priests and told all that they had seen. The priests then thought that they would try such things, and when a high enough person died they wrapped him up in bandages, coated him with spices, and all the rest of it, but they found that the bodies decayed. Then they came to the conclusion that it was the intestines, the heart, liver and lungs which caused the decaying, so all those parts were removed and put in separate jars. It is a good thing they were not preparing the hosts for incoming spirits, because the hosts would indeed have been a gutless lot, wouldn't they? Of course, Some of the embalming so-called was when a sick spaceman or spacewoman was being put into the state of suspended animation so that he or she could be removed to a spaceship and taken elsewhere for treatment. There have been quite a number of well-known leaders on this earth who were entities transmigrated into earth bodies: Abraham, Moses, Gautama, Christ, and then that well-known genius of geniuses, Leonardo da Vinci. The inventions of Leonardo da Vinci are legend, and he enhanced the knowledge of this world very, very greatly. He, as I suppose anyone would agree, possessed skills and sciences far beyond the knowledge of earth people. The person known as Leonardo da Vinci had been an illegitimate child without any special advantages. Who knows? He might even have been the son of a plumber. The body of the person who became Leonardo da Vinci was of such a degree of vibration that a very high entity could take it over and do all those things which no human could have done. In all seriousness, I say that if the people of this world would only listen to those who can actually do transmigration, there would be a wonderful chance of space exploration. Think of all the worlds there are. Think of being able to visit a world in a matter of seconds. Some of the worlds can never be visited by orthodox humans because the atmosphere may be wrong, the climate may be wrong, or the gravity may be wrong. But when a person is doing transmigration, he can take over the body of any native of the planet, and so then can explore the planet without any difficulties whatever. Humans, well versed in the science of transmigration, could enter the bodies of animals so that they could be studied effectively. This has been done before. It has been done frequently before, and because of a racial memory, there are certain false beliefs that humans are reborn as animals. They are not ever. Nor are animals born as humans. Animals are not inferior to humans, either. But because there is a racial memory of gardeners of the earth taking over the bodies of certain animals, the knowledge of that has lingered on in a distorted form. Thus it is that good religions are debased. We have traveled extensively in Canada. I have been from Windsor, Ontario, to Fort Erie and on to Prescott, and then we went to St. John, and B for a time, as you can read in others of my books. We lived quite happily in New Brunswick, in the very pleasant city beside the sea. But as my accountant said, an author must travel, so we moved to Montreal and we lived in Habitat for some time. Habitat is that funny-looking collection of houses piled one on top of the other like children's building bricks. Anyway, it was quite a nice place to live, and in fact we liked it so much that after we had left it we later returned to it. Here again, in Montreal, there were always strikes. There was a language difficulty, too, because the French Canadians were not at all friendly to those who did not speak French. And my own firm opinion has always been that Canada was an English-speaking country and I refused to speak French. Soon came the time when we moved again, this time to Vancouver, British Columbia, where we lived in a hotel, actually a hotel which also had apartments to it. Vancouver has gone down a lot lately under what I consider to be a most horrible form of government. And another complaint against Vancouver is that no pets was the sign everywhere. And as one hotel keeper once said, pets had never hurt his business but children had, and so had drunks and so had people who smoked in bed and set the place on fire. I have moved about a lot in my life. I have learned much, and there are certain things I wish could be. I wish, for instance, that there could be a censorship of the press because I have seen so much misery caused by inaccurate press reports. I am glad to note that now many more people are obviously agreeing with me on this, because the accuracy of the press is often in doubt nowadays. The predictions made about me so very, very long ago have been utterly accurate. It was predicted that even my own people would turn against me. Well, they have indeed, because in my time of trouble no one came forward to help me or to attest the truth of my story, and true that story is. I had so many hopes about helping Tibet. I thought, for example, that with recognition I would be able to speak for Tibet before the United Nations. I hoped that with recognition I could have had a radio program about Free Tibet, but no, no help whatever has been given to me by the people of Tibet who have left that country. Sadly enough, it is their loss as well as mine. So much good could have been done. My name is widely known, It has been conceded that I can write. It has been stated also that I can talk. I wanted to use both in the service of Tibet, yet they have not been at all anxious to recognize me, just the same as in the past a Dalai Lama would not recognize the Panchen Lama and vice versa. It is just the same, we will say, as one political leader ignoring the existence of another. But I get a vast number of letters, on this day, for example, I had 103. It has often been much more, and the letters come from all over the world. I learn things which are close to many, and I have been told, rightly or wrongly, that the present people who escaped from Tibet cannot recognize me because another religious faction who is helping them would be cross. I have all the evidence that that is so, actually. But well, there is no point in starting a miniature religious war, is there? It is mainly the lower orders of refugees who seem to be opposed to me. I had a letter some months ago from an important man who had been to see the Dalai Lama and had discussed me. The Dalai Lama, it was reported to me, had extended an invitation to me to return to the Potala when it was freed from communist aggression. And just a few weeks back our adopted daughter, we name no names, remember? Received a letter saying that the Dalai Lama was very concerned about Dr. Rampa's health, and the Dalai Lama was praying for him daily. That letter is now in the possession of my publishers. Another wish I have is this: there are quite a number of occult bodies about, some of them claiming to be very ancient even though they were started again by an advertising man just a few years ago. But my complaint is this: if all these people are so holy, so good, so devoted to spiritual enlightenment, then why cannot we all get together? Because if they are truly genuine, they would realize that all paths lead home. A number of students from some of these cult colleges have asked me why I did not get in touch with group so and so or group something else, and the answer is that I have done, and I have had some shockingly insulting replies from these groups, all because they are jealous or because they have been poisoned by the press. Well, I do not see it that way at all. I maintain that it does not matter what religion one belongs to, it does not matter how one studies the occult. If people are genuine, they would be able to work together. Some years ago I was approached by a man who was the founder of a so-called Tibetan science. He wrote to me and suggested that we could make a lot of money if I joined with him, and he used my name. Well, I do not do things like that. I do not go in for this work as a money-making gimmick. My beliefs are my everyday beliefs, and I live according to the code under which I was taught. I would like to see many of these so-called metaphysical societies or orders licensed after careful examination. So many of them are fakes just out to gather money. I know of one particular group who admit quite freely that they take what they consider to be the best from a whole load of writers and harsh it up as something quite different. Well, that is dishonest. This is a good opportunity to tell you once again, in case you start at the back end of this book instead of the front, as so many do, that all my books are absolutely true. Everything that I have written is fact. Every metaphysical experience I write about I can do, and it is my most sincere wish that there will come a time when people will indeed recognize the truth of my books, because I still have a lot to teach people. Nowadays, because of the lies propagated by the press, I have been treated as a leper or pariah. Many people dip into my books and then write things as if it was their own idea. Some time ago I listened with great satisfaction on short waves to a long extract from one of my books, and then at the end of the reading I was almost stunned to hear that authorship has been ascribed to some woman who can hardly sign her name. Believe me, then, all my books are true, and I believe I have the system whereby peoples of this world can visit other worlds in safety. I want to thank Mrs. Sheila M. Rouse, who has typed 15 of these books. I typed the first one. She has typed them without a groan, too. Another thing in which you may be interested is this: Mrs. Rampa has now nearly completed a book giving her side of this entire affair. If you want to know about it well, you will have to watch for advertisements, won't you? Or you can write to Mr. E. Z. Sauter 8 Touchstone Limited, 33 Ashby Road, Loughborough, England. So ends book 4, as it is now.